Welcome everybody to the, I don't have a good intro for this one. I'm just going to wing it again because I'm joined with Tim. Tim, how are you?
Hello. I'm great. I think you should probably make note of this momentous anniversary.
Yes, thank you for reminding me, considering I just made a Facebook post about it. This podcast is number 43 of our regular episodes. I don't know what the episode count would be with all the other guest episodes and special episodes we've had, but anyway, this is our two-year anniversary podcast. It's a two-year anniversary of our website slash podcast, and we couldn't think of a better way to celebrate our two-year anniversary than to speak about M. Night Shyamalan's latest film, Split. And tune out if you have not seen Split or you don't care about M. Night Shyamalan, but his rebirth of the Unbreakable universe with the epilogue of Split. Now, every time I do one of these intros, I think to myself that I probably should write something down and have something prepared beforehand, but we like to fly by the seat of our pants and stay very organic here at Podcasting Them Softly because, as a lot of you know, I make a lot of typos, and Tim gets tired of proofreading my stuff.
It's true.
So, it's true. Considering that Tim's a writer and I keep dogging him on reading his fiction that he sends to me, which I will read.
It's okay.
The second thing you sent to me.
Nobody reads my fiction.
Nobody reads anybody's fiction.
That's how it works.
That's how you know you're a writer. Because I have
exactly.
Stuff collecting dust that people say they want to read, but nobody reads it. And that's how you know you're a writer, when no one wants to read your shit.
Exactly. We are both real authors.
I feel confident in that
100% due to
writers,
the level of rejection.
Writers to our bone. But anyway, this is just, we are going to get into massive spoiler territory talking about Split and the connection to Unbreakable and what we think will happen and what we would like to happen in M. Night's follow-up to Split / Unbreakable, which has already been greenlit by the studio and he is currently writing. So,
which is great news. Now, is that Blumhouse again?
I imagine it'll be Blumhouse. When I was doing my research last night, he had to get the permission from Disney to use David Dunn in the epilogue of Split, so I imagine that Disney is now going to want a part of this next film because it was made for $9 million and made over $100 million domestically, so they're going to want to be back onto the M. Night cash cow.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely, and let me just say, too, with Shyamalan, I am so delighted to see him making this comeback and doing it very intelligently with what is relative to what he used to do, micro budgets. You know, I know you weren't a big fan of The Visit, and we can talk about that a little bit later, but you just didn't love it. I know you said it.
What bothered me about it is you could have told that story, I felt, in a more effective way without the gimmick of it being a faux documentary. Now, considering that fad has pretty much dried up, I think it's interesting that film was kind of on the tail end of it, if that makes sense to you, because I don't think they're really being made anymore. But I did like it. I like the overall message the film gave. I'm sure we'll get into it in some of his other films, because I know you and I are particular on The Village, which I'd like to speak briefly about. Not right this second, but the interesting thing to me is I did not see Split in theaters. I watched it, was it this week or last week? I think I watched
just
it last
week.
Yeah, it was last week. And I made a Facebook post that I don't want to go back and read it. I almost took the Facebook post down, but
I was going to ask you about that.
There's a lot of good discussion on the thread, and I made it apparent in the thread below that I pulled a Donald Trump and did an about face on my original post. But my initial reaction to the movie was I liked it. I think James McAvoy is incredible in this movie.
Kills it.
He is seamless. He is seamless with the different personalities that he portrays on screen, both verbally and physically. But when it got to... Let me back up. My buddy Peyton, who unfortunately moved away because of his job, we would watch movies all the time. We saw the M. Night movies in theaters together. we're big M. Night fans, and he saw Split, and this was a while ago when it was in theaters, and he's like, "Did you see Split yet?" And I'm like, "No, fuck M. Night." Like, the guy, I gave up. I was one of
those
people who gave
up. He's lost
it,
yeah.
I was one of those people who gave up on M. Night, and he's like, "Do you know?" And I'm like, "What?" He's like, "Do you know the ending?" And I'm like, "No." And he's like, "You don't know the ending." And I'm like, "No." So, okay, so when I'm watching the movie, I'm thinking, okay, M. Night's back. So I'm, like, trying to pick up clues while watching the movie of what the twist ending's going to be, what the big reveal's going to be. So it gets to the end of the movie, and it's like, okay, it's at a zoo. Okay, the girl goes back to her pervy uncle, which we'll talk about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, he lives, and he can't get hurt. Like, what the fuck? And then it just says Split. The title comes up, and I'm like, what? And then the epilogue happens, and I'm just, like, watching it, and I'm watching it, and I'm like, this music sounds familiar. And
yep.
Then, you know, it's like, the lady's like, oh, what was his name? He was in a wheelchair, Mr. Glass. And then you see Bruce Willis, and I literally jumped off my couch.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, oh, my God. I'm like, oh, my God. So then my knee-jerk reaction was, this is a bullshit cop-out to a movie that really, it's interesting, but it doesn't really go anywhere as a whole. And yet my initial reaction to this bullshit cop-out ending was, it's insanely brilliant because you just weaved back in a character from a film that a lot of us have been waiting for another one, because M. Night's been teasing a trilogy. I mean, he teased a trilogy when that came out back in 2000. That 15
fucking, years ago.
Yeah, 15,
16 years ago.
Years
old. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I remember that, too, that that was the plan. But interestingly enough, while it made plenty of money, it was not considered a hit at the time. People, you know, it's so funny to think now, because we are so just drenched in comic book material. Not only superhero comics, all sorts of comics have now been adapted since then. But back then, I mean, what he did clearly is unique, even in comic book movies, for sure. But back then, they just weren't making them. You know, I think X-Men came out
in 2000.
You know, that was 8 years before Marvel Studios fired up. You know, Batman had pretty much died on the vine, thanks Shoemaker. So there really, you know, there was just no precedent for trying to do something like that.
Right. So then on my thread, everybody jumped in on me. And I remember you said, fake news, Mengarelli, or something like that.
Exactly
then,
what I said.
And then there was two people, Bruce Pullen, who I spent the night messaging with about M. Night and the film, and then Dag Shulthot, which I'm assuming is the shitty Americanized way of pronouncing his last name.
Probably.
both these guys, particularly Dag, are like M. Night scholars. We'll post a lot of Dag's editorials on M. Night on our page to coincide with this podcast.
That's a great idea. Yep,
this guy
let's
knows
put some of his
this
stuff
guy
up.
This guy knows his shit. So anyway, essentially I got talked down from me thinking it's a bullshit ending. And Bruce and you were like, you got to watch it again. You got to watch the movie again. Like, okay. Next day, I watched the movie again, and I was literally blown away, because for a couple of reasons. First, the movie's very good on its own.
Mm-hmm.
The movie is very, very good on its own. I did have a hang up with the ending, which I don't so much anymore, particularly with the girl's storyline, which we'll get into. But here's the thing, though. A lot of people try and make the case that the epilogue is kind of bullshit, or the epilogue really doesn't make what comes prior, but they're completely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because the more I think about it, the more I think about James McAvoy's The Horde being the supervillain to David Dunn. I think about what the next movie's going to be. I think it's an insanely brilliant film. I really do, and I just rewatched Unbreakable yesterday as a refresher, because I hadn't seen that in a few years, which Unbreakable, I think it's near perfect, if not perfect. I mean, it's remarkable on all aspects. But But dissecting Split, knowing what you know after the epilogue, it's like, you know, we've spent time talking about this leading up to us recording the podcast. I don't believe in coincidences when it comes to M. Night Shyamalan when he writes. Mm-hmm. And there are dots that are on opposite ends of the spectrum between these two films that get connected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now I'm rambling on, so I would like you to jump in and save me.
Yeah, well, one of the connections that we've been talking about, and Dag is trying to shoot our math in the foot a little bit on this, but I still say, while M. Night is definitely, he's got a specific plan, I think he can play fast and loose enough with it that the idea that Kevin, a.k.a. the Horde, you know, we know he is the kid. If you didn't know this, you are dear listeners, you know, he was a character that was originally written into Unbreakable. And for whatever reason, probably because there was already enough material to work with there, they did not go into it. But when Dunn is kind of experiencing his powers under the wise tutelage of, you know, everyone's favorite grandpa, Mr. Glass, and he's out there and he is, you know, reading people, Kevin bumps into him. The little kid is being dragged along by his mom, and Frank sent me a screenshot the other night of
yeah,
it, and there's just a little blip there where you get a little read. You see a little bit of a read that it looks like he is most likely an abused child. And that's him. And then
Let me back up real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Let me back up.
Yeah.
When I read the Entertainment Weekly breakdown of Split with M. Night Shyamalan, that is a great spoiler-filled M. Night Unbreakable Split connection, he said that the janitor that Dunn bumps into at Grand Central Station that kills the mom and the dad that – like has the two kids hostage in their house.
Mm-hmm.
He said that was originally Kevin, and that was one of the personalities that that took over and did that. And mm-hmm. he ended up trimming that out because, like you said, the film had more than enough substance and more than
yep.
enough detail to it without having to overload the narrative with this. But I don't think he said anything about the mom and the kid that bump into him, which is the snap video that I sent you from yesterday when I was watching it. Now,
mm-hmm.
now this comes before that scene. This comes like in the end of the first act, the beginning of the second act, when he is at the stadium, and we're talking Unbreakable now, when Bruce Willis
yep.
is at the stadium and people are bumping into him and he's able to, you know, read them or, you know, see if they've done shitty things or bad things.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, and this mom bumps into him, and she's carrying up or she's dragging along this, like, I don't know, 5-year-old or whatever, and he turns around and looks at her because she, you know, you can kind of hear the kid screaming and her yelling at him like she's beating him. Now,
mm-hmm.
When I rewatch Split, Kevin's mom in Split, when she's trying to beat him with the coat hanger while he's underneath the bed, is blonde. The woman in Unbreakable is blonde. The blonde mom that beats her kid that bumps into Bruce Willis. Now, yeah, our buddy Dag tries to break us down with math and saying that, well, you know, that movie took place 15 years prior, in the movie Kevin has been working as a janitor at the zoo for 10 years. So pretty much the math of McAvoy's age to the little kid in Unbreakable doesn't necessarily... Actually, it doesn't really match up to the narrative of Split, but I mean that really doesn't matter because
mm-hmm.
I mean I have my own theory, which I don't know if this is correct, but you know, watching Split again, and I'll try and bridge this, but watching Split again, you know, I picked up on it my first viewing, but watching it again, it's very apparent of the psychiatrist talking about superhumans.
Mm-hmm.
Talking
mm-hmm.
about
her little Skype talk, yeah.
Right? Her Skype talk, and you know, and then when Barry, the fashion designer personality that keeps meeting with her, keeps, you know, he asks her a couple times, like, do people believe we exist? You
mm-hmm.
know, like this superhuman, this metahuman, do we exist? Now we know by the end of the film that the Horde, the Centaur, is a physical manifestation from the different from a different personality. Now, if he can physically manifest himself to this, you know, for what we've seen at the end of the film, this invincible beast, you would think that one or more of the personalities inside of Kevin could physically speed up his aging process and make him an adult.
Yeah, I don't have any problem making that bridge. And again, the fact that before he goes full on beast mode, what's the last thing he does? He goes to the train station and drops off flowers. You know, the idea that his dad was on that train that David Dunn survived at the beginning of Unbreakable. I mean, this is comic book stuff. This is comic book 101. It's storytelling 101, that they would have these connections. And how much or how little he is going to play with those is going to be a delight to see. But he's already playing with them. He's already setting that up. You know, that is a clear reference to the train accident from Unbreakable. I'm convinced of that.
I 100% agree with you there, not to cut you off, but and I think that would bring an interesting dynamic in the next film between the Horde and Mr. Glass, because then Mr. Glass is going to be responsible for Kevin's father's death.
Yeah. You know, and I was going to say, too, and I don't know what Jackson tends to charge these days. He does enough work in movies that
it.
I suspect he's... I'm sure he'd do it, and I'm sure it wouldn't be tough. My small concern, but it's just a small one, is Willis has developed a little bit of a reputation. But he also needs a hit, and I think this all sets up, assuming that M. Night comes up with good screenplay, this sets up to be a big hit. And if Disney's involved, like you said, that should open the pocketbook. I'm just saying, they're not going to be able to make the third one for $9 million.
Right. I think there's a couple of factors that say that this is going to be greenlit. Bruce Willis is going to be in it. I imagine Sam Jackson's going to be in it too. And you brought up two big points. I think the fact that Willis is in the epilogue of Split as David Dunn, connecting the two movies, means that Bruce Willis would make Unbreakable 2 or whatever this next movie is going to be called. I think the fact that ever since Stallone fired Bruce Willis from Expendables 3 and replaced him with Harrison Ford, Bruce Willis has pretty much done straight-to-VOD action movie. I mean, he's hitting Dolph Lundgren territory, which, by the way,
he is.
Dolph Lundgren's going to be in Aquaman, which made my fucking day yesterday.
Delightful
news. We're not going to get into that. But, Bruce Willis needs a hit. Bruce Willis needs a hit. I mean,
he does.
The Die Hard franchise is dead. After the last one. I mean, the Die Hard
franchise
is dead.
Let's fucking hope,
The Expendables franchise is dead now that Stallone exited.
Yeah, Sly is not there. They can stop doing
Schwarzenegger notes. Followed him.
Which I thought was a classy move. I liked seeing that.
I did, too.
Happy for both of those guys.
But, Bruce Willis isn't going to be making $20 million per movie anymore. You know, I mean, if we're talking budgets, the budget to the next film is going to be bigger than $9 million. I don't know how much bigger, but maybe it'll be a mid-range budget, which we tend not to see anymore. But anyway, in that Entertainment Weekly article that I mentioned prior, M. Night was asked about, and this was my question too after I first saw the movie, like, did he have this epilogue written for Split, or was this epilogue, like, waiting for him to use in a movie? You know, was it just kind of his way to bring back Unbreakable without writing anything before it? If that makes sense to you, like, did he already have the epilogue and he just needed a movie to make to latch it onto? Which he said that, you know, the movie, most of Split was already written with Unbreakable. He went back and rewrote it, but yes, the epilogue was always attached to this movie, and he said that he was up front with James McAvoy about it. And said that, like, hey, this is part of the Unbreakable universe. And he said James McAvoy flipped out, and he's like, you mean I'm going to be in a movie with Bruce Willis? And he's just like, well, if everything goes right, yeah, but let's make this movie first and see what happens.
Right.
It's almost I feel like after you watch Split, it's kind of like after you see The Prestige. With the big reveal of Christian Bale being twins. It's like, no shit.
Yeah, I knew that.
How is he going to pull this off? It's like, but I had no idea watching the movie that Christian Bale had a twin. You know, it was like one of those things that was so obvious that, like, you
I kind of figured that one out early, but I will say I love this. I love the Hugh Jackman bit. The fact that in order to beat him, he actually goes and figures out a way to clone himself and then die every night. That's ridiculous. But anyway,
but I remember Split, Unbreakable. You know, the titles are symbiotic. The fucking posters
are flow together.
Symbiotic.
They've got the glass break effect.
Right.
I think, when M. Night is really on his game, he is a great trickster. You know, he's always got that third act twist. Not always, but he's well known for that. And I think this is probably one of his best that he's ever pulled off.
It feels
very organic and very him.
I agree, and I don't necessarily think it's a twist, and that's what I think is so great about it. It's not like it's a twist ending. It's not like, oh, Bruce Willis is really dead, and Haley Joel Osment's the only one that can see him. Mm-hmm. It's not with Signs, everything is happening for a reason, and everything that Mel Gibson went through was preparing him for the alien invasion and being able to, protect his family from the alien. It's not the twist ending of The Village of, it's actually happening in present day, and this was just a way to escape the shittiness of society.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, we don't have a twist, but it's actually Unbreakable 1.5.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. It is incredibly organic.
It is, and I understand why it kind of smacked you in the face the first time you saw it, when you're kind of like, what the fuck?
Right.
And how, you're kind of talked down off the cliff, like you said. Because in rewatching it, it flows nicely. The movie itself has, in retrospect, you look at it and you're like, of course it's set in the Unbreakable universe. It feels very much that way. It's a dark place. It's a dark universe. Life is
dark, hard.
Yeah. There are not easy victories. You know, there's no easy victory for Dunn in Unbreakable.
Even when you think
he's scored one, then you discover that he's actually been manipulated by a supervillain the whole time. And here, you don't get a pat, the Casey Cook, the Anna Taylor-Joy's character, who is we need to talk about her too. You know, she doesn't get a big victory. She gets to survive,
right?
But that's all she's ever been as a survivor, and that's the kind of victories you get in the Unbreakable universe. You don't get the big, blasting in with a shotgun and killing the bad guy.
The only thing that survives in Unbreakable is his marriage.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's really the only positive.
A big victory. That's a big victory there, which really begs the question about where his family is at, how they'll handle that in the third one. I'm very curious to see if they bring Robin Wright Penn and his son back.
Oh, I imagine so.
They'll have to deal with them, but that's another great thing about the coda there, is they give you so little information aside from the fact that that's David Dunn sitting there. You know, he could have won the lottery and he's having a cup of coffee before the links. That's not it. I'm just saying, you don't know a darn thing about what's happened to him in the last 15 years.
I mean, I've watched the epilogue quite a few times,
mm-hmm.
Since I bought the digital copy, and Willis isn't really jacked up. He was never overly jacked, but you know what I mean.
The character isn't. Yeah.
And neither, but he was Bruce Willis in Unbreakable. He was built up. He was muscular. I mean, he was never Stallone, Schwarzenegger, Lundgren, but beefed mm-hmm. up.
Yeah.
But now David Dunn at the end of Split looks like an average guy with an average middle-aged body. I mean, you don't see him with a but he's noticeably, skinnier. He's mm-hmm. older, and he's in a uniform that has his last name on the, his mm-hmm. embroidered on a patch that's sewn onto his blue-collar workwear shirt.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know what the fuck he's been doing for the past 15 years, because I want to spend some time on this, because I get the impression that he hasn't been saving the world.
No. He's been doing it at a very low-key clip, most likely, and always was a low-key character, so that doesn't surprise me. But my guess is that he, after, you know, when he goes tearing out of Mr. Glass's exhibit after he realizes what this guy has done, I wouldn't be surprised if he turned around and hung up the raincoat for these 15 years because it just fucked with him so bad.
It's that also possible that he's never had a reason to do anything because there's never been another him that he's had to go up against, and that's an important aspect of the end of Unbreakable, is that there's no brute force for David Dunn to go up against.
Yeah.
There's no Bane to Batman, there's no Zod to Superman, there's no, you know, Venom to Spider-Man. There's none of that. You get the Joker, you get the Lex Luthor, you get the Brainiac out of Mr. Glass.
Mm-hmm.
But with Split and the Horde, you get the brute force. You get that character that's on that pencil drawing that's in the opening of Unbreakable with, you know, the Action Comics cover of the Superman fighting the Beast. I mean, that's what this next movie is going to be, because the Horde is a centaur. And I imagine that in the next film, he's going to have longer, he's going to look more beast-like. He's going to have evolved into a beast. But backing up briefly, what's your interpretation of his reaction? Because they hold the camera on Bruce Willis for a good 30 seconds, 45 seconds after he says Mr. Glass, drinks his coffee, is looking at the TV, and then just kind of like looks over his shoulder.
I think the gears are starting to grind, you know, and I mean grind. I don't mean that they're running smoothly, because I, again, suspect we are not going to find a happy with his place in the universe, David Dunn, when we get back into that third film, when we finally get it. I suspect that he kind of knows, you know, there's a recognition there that this might be up my alley, but maybe he hasn't been down that alley in 15 years. Maybe it's something he really doesn't want to have. And, you know, a reluctant hero, that seems definitely the way they could go with it. I don't know, though. You know, I think Knight could surprise us. Just backing up on him real quick, too, because we alluded to the fact that you had kind of given up on M. Knight for a while, and I think most people had. I have seen every movie he's made except for Lady in the Water. And
okay.
I saw a couple of his movies by dint of having young kids who wanted to see him. I saw After Earth, and I saw Last Airbender, and they were not good matches to him. He's a guy who needs to write his own shit, first of all. He was trying for a while to be a studio hand after Lady in the Water, and he was trying to rebuild stuff, and that was the wrong way for him to go. I think he really needed to keep writing and keep doing his own stuff. I'm delighted he's back doing that. But I wanted to say, one of the things that I think that he's returned to, and he clearly has returned to in Split, that is his own superpower. I think he's great with actors when he's really on. I think he's great with actors, and I think he's great at writing good characters. I think he's good at the character work, and that's why you care. That's why you care. You know, you're practically in tears a half dozen times during Signs, and that's an alien invasion movie, you know. But he built up that family so nicely, and I think here, obviously, the Horde is just a frickin' actor's paradise. And I'm sure he probably did not have a tough time casting it, because anybody who looked at this, any actor who looked at this, would be like, this is a fucking playground. Sign me up, please. I'll do it for peanuts. And I'll bet McAvoy was like that. But you see him work with McAvoy and do some of his best character work he's ever done. And I think he does killer character work with the girl, with Casey, as well. I think she's a very well-drawn, complicated character. I love it at the beginning when the three girls are first thrown together into their cell, and they're left alone, and the other two girls, they just go all girl power. And what are we going to do? We can take this guy. And she just looks at them like, you don't fucking know. You know what? I've been a victim for a long time, and this shit doesn't play out like it does in the movies. And she sells that really well. And McAvoy, you can talk about this too. We were talking about this before we fired up the call here, but He does such wonderful work in each and every character he does. And even, let's not forget that one of those visits to the psychiatrist, he's actually doing Dennis impersonating Barry, and she picks up on that. And that's a really interesting scene, too, where you've just got the layer upon layer, and he kills it. So I'm in closing on that little diatribe, I'm really glad to see Shyamalan has gone back to good character work, because in stuff like The Happening, those were flat performances. You just didn't care about anybody running around there. And he's back to really doing good actor work, so good for him.
I completely agree with you. I have to rewatch The Sixth Sense. I haven't seen it since it came out, but I wasn't blown away by it. I saw the twist coming. I actually saw the twist coming with Unbreakable, but that didn't hinder my viewing of it at all. But you're right. M. Night Shyamalan's great at two things. Well, he's great at three things. He's great at writing/character development. He's great at direction, and he's great at casting. And casting, and where I'm going to go with this doesn't really pertain to Split too much, but he was really great at casting against type. He cast Bruce Willis as a doctor, you know. He cast Bruce Willis as the timid and what's the word I'm looking for? He cast him as the timid and uninterested superhero.
Yeah, he's the polar opposite of John McClane, which up to that point we had John McClane, we had Butch, and Pulp Fiction, best roles.
Right, and you know, and then he casts Mel Gibson as the priest that lost his wife. He casts William Hurt as the patriarch to a colonial settlement. He cast Sigourney Weaver against her badass woman power persona as like the stoic and reserved matriarch. But I think his career started to slip for most people with The Village.
A lot of people reacted poorly
to The Village. I like Lady in the Water. People hated that. I bought the DVD of The Happening at Walmart when it came out. I never saw it in theaters, and I hated The Happening.
It's not a good movie.
I thought it was a really good idea, but as you said, the performances are flat.
It's
Mark
really
Wahlberg
flat. Bizarrely flat. Yeah.
Zooey Deschanel is terrible.
She really is, and those are two people who can turn in fine performances.
I agree.
You know, she's pretty charming. Wahlberg's been around long enough now that if he's in the hands of a good director, then he does good work usually. So, yeah, absolutely. But
I never saw The Last Airbender. I never saw After Earth. I watched The Visit after I watched Split. I didn't like it as much as I wanted to. I felt that he made that movie for eighth graders, which your response to me was, well, my kid, sorry, I didn't like it that much, but my kids enjoyed it. It's like, oh, okay. Well,
they did.
You,
they
Tim.
Did. It
but,
was a good thriller for kids. They loved it. Yeah. You didn't even get a little stiff at the diaper scene. Come on. You're kind of a sick twist.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, okay. I didn't like how there was a camera. I did not like the way it was made. I didn't like the faux documentary. I didn't like that. You saw the twist of who the grandparents were coming before it happened.
Mom did a really good, really lousy job of dropping off the kids and not really checking to make sure that those are actually her parents. But
Catherine Hahn was good in it. But with Split was a fierce return to character development. You know, I'm not crazy about the girl's storyline. You know what's going on. There's one thing that bothers me is the actor who plays her dad. I've seen him in a few things. He's most well known for the first two seasons of House of Cards, and he's great in it. He's in one or two episodes of The Leftovers because he's Carrie Coon's husband that's in a flashback, and then I can't remember the other thing I've seen him in. But I don't buy that he's the blue collar hunter in the movie. But that's pretty much a moot point. But the whole hunting aspect and the whole struggle of her being a predator, being prey slash a predator, you know, a hunter, is a good head fake for the end of the movie, because it's like the whole movie's building to her as growing up as a hunter. She's going to kill the beast,
right?
You know, and it's like, oh wait, no.
Yeah, but I think he gets. I think he takes the opportunity to say some more interesting things
great.
about victimhood and things like that.
No,
so,
I agree. I think her performance is great. She's wonderful. Mm-hmm. She's great in The Witch.
Yeah,
she's great in The Witch. She's,
yeah,
she's really good.
I hope she has a great future because she's magnetic. Yeah.
The ending of the movie, when I first watched it, I thought it was like, well, there's no resolution here. She goes back to her rapist uncle. Like, what? What the fuck, M. Night? Like, you're so good at writing, and then you just, like, write this off.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I watched it again and again and again, I become further more convinced in my personal theory that I think in the next movie she is going to work with the Horde.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to be, you know, killing impure people, or there's going to be some sort of struggle between the two of them, because the Horde's just going to want to eat everybody's innards.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's going to focus on, you know, predators.
I think she could be a really pivotal character. And you know, talking about the ending too, I want to mention this because it's important. I do every time we podcast, and that's Joss Whedon and what he had to say about Empire Strikes Back. One of your favorite films and one of mine as well, when he was bagged on by the internet.
Come up.
Well, I'll just let me go
okay,
here. I'll explain
go
it perfectly.
It.
So he got a lot of flack a few years ago when he said he didn't like the ending of Empire because it didn't end. It wasn't an enclosed story. I disagree with him, but I don't disagree with the point here that it does feel like it just kind of ends, but there's a purpose to it, obviously, which is that final trick, which is to tell you this story's not over. The final trick tells you this story is not over. There is more to this story. Because it is really, you know, the Horde's on the loose. He's fine. She's back with creepy asshole molester uncle,
thing, though,
and that's
like,
a terrible way to end it. Well, that is kind of up for debate, isn't it?
Does she tell the cop?
I don't know that. I don't,
but and here's,
don't
here's
know
the thing
that,
that I noticed too, is directly after that stare down between her and the police woman that says your uncle's here to pick you up, is a shot for like 15-20 seconds of a lion,
mm-hmm.
over its, you know, with the big mane, standing protecting its mate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not there accidentally. That's not there for a filler shot.
Yeah, but
is that the Horde protecting her?
Yeah, but what are we? Yeah, what is it? What is she doing? What is she doing there? And
is she
and
about
I
a human too?
I don't think we're really given anything to indicate that, are we?
No.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the Horde seeing her? He sees something in her other than she's a victim. You notice at the opening of the film when he gasses the two chicks in the back,
mm-hmm.
and then she just sits there?
Yeah, he doesn't gas her right away.
And doesn't gas her right away, and it's not until she opens the door and he hears the car dinging that he looks at, that the camera cuts to him and he's staring at her, and it's pretty. That's a pretty startling scene. That's a very nicely shot and cut scene. I will mention that the DP who shot this, I don't know his name off the top of my head. I'm surprised you haven't brought this
just
up.
Just going to say that. I was
he
just
shot
say it.
Your favorite, one of your favorite films from last year, and a film that I loved from last year, It Follows.
Yes, he did, and I'm looking up his name now. And yes, I was actually, that was on the tip of my tongue. He does marvelous work, too. I hope this is a guy, and I know that, you know, some directors, they work with the same DP all the time. Some directors, it just depends on schedule, and they might switch off and work with half a dozen or whatever. I hope this collaboration continues, because I thought when I saw that, what a perfect combination. Because
is
here,
It Follows Blumhouse?
No. Strangely, I don't believe It Follows was Blumhouse. I'm trying to remember.
Okay.
The studio was off the top of my head, which is rare because Blumhouse is so ubiquitous. I mean, they have really done a great job of cornering the market on good low-budget horror.
I think it's in that Entertainment Weekly article that M. Night picked him because of It Follows.
Oh, is that right? Yeah, that would make perfect sense.
But back to what
Mike
we were saying.
Mike Bielakis is his name.
There's something different about her character her character is shrouded in mystery, and I know the big reveal is that she's been molested by her uncle since she was a little girl when her dad died of a heart attack, but there's more to her than that. I honestly feel like, and I feel like at the end, the big climax, the Horde sees something more than her just being a victim.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very solid theory, because and you've watched it more recently than me, but she's flawed, she's impure, she's broken like him. Isn't that kind of the
pure because she's broken.
Pure because she's broken.
Because there's something about her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the characters treat her differently. Granted, she treats different personalities differently, but there is more of a kinship, maybe too strong of a word, but there's a liking, you know, between the, I'm drawing a blank, what's the little kid's name? The kid personality.
Danny?
No, it's not Danny. It's
Hedwig.
Hedwig. Hedwig. Yeah, Hedwig. How could you forget that? You know, Hedwig and then Patricia. And... you know, there's something more to her than just, you know, she's a victim of sexual abuse.
Yeah. It's interesting mentioning those names, too, about how, especially when you rewatch it, you realize that there are good guys and bad guys within Kevin. And you don't quite know on a few of them. You figure it out pretty quick. But the fact that, you know, Dennis and Patricia are bad guys.
Yeah, but isn't Hedwig a bad guy?
I don't think Hedwig's a bad guy, no.
Are you
sure?
Because Hedwig's one of the three, well, I guess four if you consider the Horde. But Hedwig's working with Patricia and Dennis.
But Hedwig is a mental midget. Hedwig is, you know, I don't think
Hedwig's like a 10-year-old kid, though. That's the thing about Hedwig. He's a little kid.
Yeah, he's a kid, but I think he's got more. He maybe is a kid with a disability too. I think that might be fair to say. And it'd be interesting to read up on McAvoy's comments on the character and see what he had to say about that. But I took him as a kid, not only a young kid, but a kid maybe with some issues. And a kid, as she indicates, as she shows, she illustrates through her trying to work him over. He's a very easy to manipulate kid. And,
well, I think he's being abused by Patricia and Dennis.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So, I mean, there's almost a kinship there that she has with him because of that. She's trying to work him to her advantage to get out of that place, clearly. But there is also some kinship there, and that comes back to the abuse angle. That's a good catch.
But yeah, I do think there's something more to her character. I think she is. I'd be like 90% sure that she's going to be in the next film.
Yeah, she has to be. I don't think they can leave
that
hanging.
That character is too important to not bring into the next film. The next film is going to be big. That's going to be big. I mean, I feel like that's going to have to be the best thing he's ever written.
To
thread everything together.
Yeah, and he's been living with these characters, obviously, for a long time, and he is on – that's why I'm hopeful, number one. Number two, he's on an upward trajectory creatively. I think he is back to doing what he does well, and, you know, based on the last couple that he's put out, he seems to have kind of rediscovered – I don't know if he lost his joy for the craft for a while or what, but he seems to have rediscovered –
I think he got shamed pretty hard, like George Lucas shamed.
Yeah.
You know, Time Magazine had him on the cover. He's the next Spielberg, you know, and then he just started making these movies that didn't really resonate with the people that wanted that, like, big twist, that grand twist to completely blow their minds in the theaters. And then he made The Last Airbender, and then he made After Earth, and it's just like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
You know?
It was bad. After Earth is another one where there are some serious sleepwalking performances and just not just didn't feel like a good fit. Even though there's a couple interesting ideas running around in there, but it's funny, everybody always calls him the next Spielberg, and what I always think is, well, they did for a time anyway. But what I always think, he has always struck me as the next Alfred Hitchcock, that he was trying to be a Hitchcock guy in the sci-fi and horror genres, in genre stuff, not just do straight thrillers like Hitchcock did for the most part, but take the toolbox of what Hitchcock did in playing with the audience and then applying that to the genre stuff that he clearly loved. He's clearly a kid who grew up reading comic books and watching monster movies and stuff, you know. And I think in his early work, he did a pretty good job of that. I think his chosen subject matter is often different enough from what you classically think of with Hitch that you might not immediately go there. But he wants to be, like Hitch was, a grand showman who can line up, you know, children from age 8 to 80 and take them on a ride for 2 hours. And, you know, because Hitchcock was a great showman. He just wanted to have fun. As great an artist as he was, he wanted to, as he once said, play the audience like a piano. And I think that M. Night, I think he does that pretty well when he's on, and he appears to be back to it. And I'm pretty delighted by that.
Yeah. I agree. I think on scope he's Spielberg-esque,
mm-hmm.
but when it comes to plot devices and tropes and narrative turns, he's very Hitchcockian. He's kind of like a hybrid between the two.
Yeah, no,
when
totally.
He's on.
Mm-hmm. When he's on, and Spielberg brings the genre stuff, obviously. He's done a ton of sci-fi
Spielberg's made some dogs, too. I mean, Hitchcock never really quite made a dog, but, I mean, he made some underwhelming films.
He made, when you make 50 movies, you're not going to make all of them perfect. That's just not the way it works. And, you know, people forget that Spielberg kind of started to get lost in the weeds a little bit in the 80s, right around the time he made Empire of the Sun, which was not well taken. And he made Always.
Which
nobody went and saw that. That was a legit bomb. I mean, he went back. Obviously, Schindler's List was a huge
Jurassic
hit.
Jurassic Park.
And then Jurassic Park. That's what I was going to say. So
he never
totally fell off the radar.
But I mean, he also made War of the Worlds.
Closer. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Which is actually one of my favorite Spielbergs.
Are you serious?
I love War of the Worlds. I think it's an absolute disgusting delight. I love his conception. Now, the device of having Tom Cruise have to be in the center of everything the whole time gets pretty tired, but I think he does a good job of not showing the monster a lot of the time, having everything happening just off.
I have it until
he shows you the real stuff. I mean, the sequence when the alien first comes up out of the ground and starts incinerating people, and the sequence on the boat. Those are two of my favorite Steven Spielberg sequences.
God, I haven't seen that in a while. I do have a Tom Cruise set on Blu-ray that's got, you know, most of Tom Cruise's seminal stuff like Days of Thunder, Top Gun, mm-hmm. Mission Impossible, all that stuff on it.
Yeah.
And War of the Minority Report's on there, which I love.
Minority is another one of my favorite Spielbergs.
But,
yeah.
It does have War of the Worlds on there, and I don't think I've watched it since I saw it in theater, so I should
give another
that
spin.
One.
There's some really fun, gory stuff in there.
I was just turned off that it was like a post-9/11 movie, and like Dakota Fanning, like through the whole of the first act, like, is this the terrorists? It's like, Jesus Christ, I know 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
Speaking of 9/11,
mm-hmm.
you brought up something that I had always loved about The Village.
Yes.
And I don't think that a lot of people draw this parallel to. Let me start by saying I don't really like when movies use 9/11 as a plot device.
It can get pretty heavy-handed, yeah.
I think that Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close is just an awful movie. I think Remember Me, that Robert Pattinson thing, was just obnoxious with the use of 9/11.
You know, kudos for actually sitting through it, because I don't seek out these.
You've not seen that? It's a love story.
A Robert Pattinson. I know the ending. No, I know what it is.
He dies at the end of the movie because he's in the World Trade. It's like, are you fucking serious right now?
This is
the movie? This is like the fucking climate. But anyway.
Yeah.
But I think The Village is a brilliant way of dealing with 9/11.
Exactly. The Village is easily my favorite post 9/11 big budget Hollywood.
Mine's 25th Hour.
Mm-hmm.
But it deals with it in a very similar, maybe not a very similar way, similar to similar to the degree that it's very low key.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But anyway, yes.
No, the fear mongering that the town elders engage in to keep people safe, and just the idea, you know, there's always this American idea that in the past, that's when times were good. Times are shitty now. But back in the 50s or, you know, 1900 or whatever, pick it out of a bag, that was the really good time. And I think that his brain very nicely curled around that concept and came up with this concept for the village. And it's one of his twists. It's one of my favorites. And I've seen some people online just go try and hack it apart. And it's like, why? They drop a little line about rerouting some air traffic overhead, and they're rich. They pooled their resources and bought a bunch of fucking land and started having babies there and doing it. You know, it's perfectly fine to me. You've got to suspend your disbelief when you're watching these movies anyway. And if you're not prepared to do that, if you're just going to pick, I don't know, go fucking bitch on Reddit about it or something. I don't care. You know, have some fun. This is the movies. This is escapism. And, you know, that's why I can cut him some slack. As long as he's doing what he does well, then I can, let's say, forgive some slippery birthday math on Kevin to say, you know, that's pretty clear what he's trying to do, even if
I
really dig in there and nitpick, then yeah, whatever.
I think you would really, really, really like Lady in the Water.
You know, it's funny because after I saw Split, I started to watch it, and then I got yanked out of it. I had to go, you know, do something family-related or something. So I did not get to watch all of it, but it's funny because as I've gotten older, when I was younger, people used to say I look like Andrew McCarthy, and now that I'm old and graying and balding, everyone says I look like Paul Giamatti. So, you know,
I don't see Paul Giamatti. I don't see Andrew McCarthy.
It's more just a straight up Cary Grant. I mean, look at that profile.
But I don't see Paul Giamatti at all.
It's etched in stone right here. Yeah. Anyway, so I'm always down for my soulmate Paul Giamatti, and you know, for the first 15 minutes or so that I saw, I wasn't scared off by it. It did feel not different, but it felt a little off from what I was expecting, from what I remember expecting from Shyamalan movies.
It's just a very nice fable.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
An adult-oriented fairy tale.
Mm-hmm. I did think that the opening preamble to kind of lay the groundwork was a little heavy-handed. It was kind of like, if you have to tell us this much, you know, there's telling you and then there's showing you. And as a movie maker, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to be showing people.
I think he got a little pretentious, but
yeah, that may be. And he was riding high at that time. The Village was a little bit of a controversial hit, but it was a hit. I mean, that made the money, and everybody came out because his name was stamped on it. So, yeah, and maybe that's part of why he's come back nicely, is because the ego, you know, the I'm the king of the world shit has kind of
I'm
been
the next removed. Spielberg.
Yeah, it's kind of been removed from his career, and he's gotten projects off the ground. He wrote Devil, didn't he? That elevator thriller.
Yeah, you know what? He wrote and produced Devil. I liked that movie, and I'm not a huge horror movie guy. I like some horror movies. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
But Devil, I don't know if you saw it. I liked Devil a lot.
I thought it was okay.
It was a good movie.
It was very small. You know, it doesn't have a lot. It's got a pretty small concept, and it runs through it, and it's kind of a little more disposable than some of his other ones, you know, because in his other ones, even in the ones where he's misfiring a little bit, like The Happening, he's trying to struggle with big themes, you know.
I honestly felt like he wasn't allowed to direct Devil.
Mm-hmm. At the time, there were supposed to be, if that had worked, okay, so I think the guys who made that, yeah, well, he was going
to
do a series of movies where he would write them and or produce them and then have some up-and-coming horror or other genre filmmakers direct them. And there was a pair of guys, and they did a found footage. I don't know if they did. It wasn't Wreck. It was like, I can't remember. Anyway, but they had come from the found footage genre, had done something that was fairly well thought of, and then they did this, and God, I haven't heard of them since then, so I'm not sure. I don't think the movie really made that much of an impression on anyone. I don't think it made anybody a lot of money, so it just kind of didn't. That whole plan fizzled out. But if that fizzling out thus led to M. Night getting back into his own deal, then that's fine. That's fine that that kind of petered out. Okay, so Quarantine, as above, so below, No Escape.
No Escape with Ray Liotta?
Poughkeepsie Tapes is what I'm thinking of. Poughkeepsie Tapes is what that guy
did. Really? No Escape with Ray Liotta just went over your head, huh? Have you not seen that movie?
Oh, my God, that's right. That's the I have not
that's
seen
like
that
the,
movie.
Dude, No Escape's awesome.
Is it? Oh, okay. I'll check it out. I mean, I know it was pretty whack conceptually from what I read about it.
It's like Escape from New York. It's like he gets dropped on this futuristic island. It's in the future, and it's like all these hardcore criminals get dropped off on this island, and it's like Lord of the Flies, where they just have to like fend for themselves. It's got fucking Ernie Hudson in it, dude.
Mm-hmm. It's got Ernie Hudson in it. I'm sold. Sold.
And Lance Henriksen.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's got
a whole cast.
And Owen Wilson, right? Are we thinking of the same one?
That's a different No Escape.
Totally different No Escape. I was like,
totally different.
Remember
No.
This being a
Ray Liotta. The Ray Liotta No Escape's a '90s movie.
Okay. No, that's funny because I'm looking at the poster right now, and from a distance, that could be Ray Liotta on the bottom, but actually, it's Pierce.
Yeah, but No.
Because they're escaping from like a third world country that's undergoing a coup or some shit like that.
I have no idea what this movie is you're talking about. I just know the Ray Liotta No Escape, the Snapcase DVD.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Bantz, I know you're listening. You have to have that movie.
That sounds like a Bantz special right there.
Right.
It does. It totally does.
Snapcase DVD at a dollar at a record store. But, I like Double. I'm very excited about this. I'm very excited. I was very excited to talk about these two movies. I guess we talked about Split more so than Unbreakable, but I'm very excited about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so happy that M. Night's back because...
Yeah.
I'm like a born-again believer.
Mm-hmm. I am too. I totally am, after really not caring what he was going to do again for, like a decade now. I will say about Unbreakable, and then if you want to jump in and add anything, please do. But like I said earlier, there was no precedent, barely any precedent. We had some Batman movies that, the series had gone down the toilet once Schumacher got a hold of it. And then we had Superman. Another series that went down the toilet after a couple strong outings. So nobody was really clamoring for anything like this. And not only did he come out and make what I think most film geeks would tell you is one of the best comic book movies ever made, which is marvelous because it's an original property. It's not even based on an existing title like all the ones are these days. But at every turn, he goes against what are the, the tropes of the genre. It's not an action movie. It's not fast-paced. There is no car chase. There's no chase. There, these things that you just come to expect from, that you would have expected even then, the things you got from X-Men, which is another example of a comic book movie that came out in 2000. Even the fight scene is done, so I don't know if in watching that you noticed it, It's just this clumsy wrestling match where he just puts gets him in this kind of clumsy half Nelson thing and chokehold, and he's trying to choke him out. And then, of course, there's the water thing. That's his kryptonite. That's he got injured, or he didn't technically get injured, but he came pretty darn close to it that rainy night back in high school. And how it all almost gets him here. It's all well done. It hits. It checks all the boxes without checking any of the boxes. Does that make sense?
No,
I love that about it.
I agree with you. The thing that I like about it is it gets into the mythology of superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
And it explains the animation, which is something that I particularly don't really give a shit about when I read comic. I don't really read comic books. I read graphic novels.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really care so much about the drawing as I do about the story of, say, Watchmen or The Dark Knight Returns or, Volume 1 of Swamp Thing or, the handful of graphic novels that I've read.
Mm-hmm.
I like the story, but Unbreakable does a very good job of explaining to you why things are drawn the way they're drawn.
Mm-hmm.
it does a very good job of explaining the concepts to the adult concepts, the thematic concepts to you,
yep,
without hitting it too hard,
mm-hmm,
without being overbearing, without without putting everything on a platter for you, like, you know, like how you talked about the prologue to Lady in the Water,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
where it doesn't lay everything out.
So anyway, you're in total league with Mr. Glass because he is the comic book nerd that M. Night Shyamalan was, but he just went down the wrong path with it. And I think that's just great. I think it's very in keeping with the genre and just in keeping with, obviously, the way he does twists and all that. But was there anything else about Unbreakable you want to say?
Yeah, but we should probably wrap it up. Unbreakable is just a very fine film. I don't think that this next movie is going to be able to top Unbreakable, but I would love it if it did.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that what makes Unbreakable so special is, like what you said, it's the anti-superhero film. The entire film is a slow burn.
Mm-hmm. It really is.
The entire film is a slow burn that builds up to the big reveal.
Mm-hmm. And it's stitched together so nicely. But again, at every turn, he does what he wants to do. He does not do what the barely born genre would dictate. And, you know, we see it now dictated time and again over and over. It's brilliant stuff. And I'm so glad he's back in that universe. And so glad apparently we're going to get some more of it. That's just amazing to me.
Yeah, I can't even wait, man.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be
mm-hmm.
jumping at the bit. So next week we are going to be back with some sort of mega episode podcast that is going to deal with Star Wars, because we are going to get the Last Jedi trailer today, but you're listening to this. Yeah, I was going to say tomorrow, because we're recording it the day before you guys listen to this, where the Last Jedi trailer should probably come out around the same time as our podcast. So,
you can probably anticipate like a 4-hour podcast from Frank and I breaking down the trailer relentlessly next week.
Mm-hmm. that's pretty much what's going to happen.
Yep,
that's
perfect.
Pretty much what's going to happen. So until next time, thank you everybody for listening. It's been an amazing 2 years.
Absolutely.
Yep, thank you for not saying anything more eloquent than absolutely. So, anyway, we bid you guys adieu, and we'll catch you next week.
Sounds good.